I'm Mike Collins. Listener support powers the coverage from WFAE that you rely on in good times and bad. As reporters and producers keep you updated on the coronavirus and its impact on the community, we hope that you'll consider a donation to WFAE at WFAE.org or by calling 704-549-9000. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins on the local news roundup. The stay-at-home order in North Carolina is extended. Coronavirus cases rise, and so does the ire of some who have been thrown out of work. Protests erupt in the state. Despite that, Governor Cooper has extended that stay-at-home order, even as South Carolina decides to begin reopening, starting with the beaches. Atrium Health faces a cost crunch during the pandemic and cuts some hours and the pay of health care workers. And the man at the center of the District 9 voter fraud scandal, McCray Dallas, faces a new federal charge, this time for Social Security fraud. Our roundtable of reporters is ready, and they include WFAE's healthcare reporter Claire Donnelly and WFAE's education reporter Ann Doss Helms. Good morning, Claire.
Good morning.
Good morning, Ann.
Good morning from Belmont.
Yes, Nick Oxner is WBTV's investigative executive producer. Good morning to you.
Heidi ho, long time no talk.
Exactly. And Eric Spanberg is back. He's managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Hello to you.
Good morning, Mike.
I'm going to buy you a brush.
Do you also do haircuts?
Yeah, we all need haircuts. Let's begin with where we always begin on these coronavirus updates, with the numbers. North Carolina has gone from 1,886 cases 3 weeks ago to 7,801 this morning, from 144 deaths last week to 275 this morning. Mecklenburg County went from 495 cases 3 weeks ago to 1,377 today. That's the highest number in the state and the second sharpest one-day rise from Wednesday to Thursday since this all began in early March. 37 people have died so far in Mecklenburg County, and statewide, about 500 people are hospitalized. So despite all those numbers, Claire, are we flattening the curve statewide and or in Mecklenburg County?
Yeah, so we are. So what flattening the curve means basically is that the hospitals are not likely to become overwhelmed. So you are slowing how quickly the number of cases is rising so that hospitals don't become overwhelmed. So we, so far so good. Yeah, on that. The social distancing, according to health officials, seems to be working. It's not quite where they want it to be, but the curve is flattening.
And yet yesterday, despite all of that, Governor Cooper extended the state's stay-at-home order.
It's clear that we are flattening the curve, but our state is not ready to lift restrictions yet. We need more time to slow the spread of the virus before we can begin easing those restrictions. So today, I'm extending the stay-at-home order until May the 8th.
And State Health Director Mandy Cohen has said, he said this yesterday, that aggressive stay-at-home precautions have helped to flatten this curve. How is it that we're flattening the curve, Claire, but the state also says it has not seen a decline in cases, even with social distancing and the stay-at-home orders in place? Explain that to me.
Yeah, so part of that comes from testing. So obviously, the more people you test, the more positive cases you're going to get. And recently, we've started to see in the state and in the country increased testing capacity. So they're able to test more people, which means that they're finding more positive cases. And that just sort of makes sense if you think about it, right? The more tests you run, the more positives you'll find. That doesn't mean that overall that we're seeing like a spike in cases. Actually, Mandy Cohen said yesterday that she feels like what North Carolina might actually end up seeing is kind of a gradual leveling that will then sustain. And that's kind of now what they're shooting for. Does that make sense?
Yep. So the curve is flattened, but they keep moving the stay-at-home date end date out. It was, I think, first to have been in mid-April, and then now they're saying that not the end of stay-at-home order, but the peak has moved from mid-April now to June 8th. And yesterday, Projections showed a probable peak of demand at hospitals between mid-June and mid-July. And the county's deputy health director, Raynard Washington, says this is a positive.
We are successfully, effectively flattening the curve in our community. As a result of that, we really are, that we expect, as long as we're implementing measures to avoid additional cases and surges, that the peak dates will continue to be pushed out further.
So, Nick, how is that a positive? If we keep pushing the peak date out, that means that maybe the stay-at-home orders will have to be pushed further out. How is this a positive?
Not necessarily. So, first of all, Mike, when you talk about the differences in the models and the peak dates moving, one, we're looking at different models, but two, there's still a peak. The peak is just significantly less higher. And again, when you flatten the curve, that doesn't mean you have fewer cases. It means you have fewer cases at a time. So you're moving those cases down over periods of time. And so right now, the county modeled projected hospital usage on three different scenarios of levels of stay-at-home order, basically. If we have a lot of stay-at-home order still, if we have some stay-at-home order, or if we have a relatively little bit of stay-at-home order. And so basically, it's trying to test if we do away with or we start relaxing the stay-at-home order, what will that do to our spread of the virus and our need for hospital resources? And so when they say they expect a peak in mid-June to mid-July, depending on the level of stay-at-home order that ultimately ends up in place, that's what they're talking about.
Mecklenburg County Health Director Gibby Harris talked to the press yesterday before the governor extended the stay-at-home order. They were hoping that he would, and they were suspecting that he would, and in fact he did. But she was talking about how a two-week extension of the county stay-at-home order, which it will now happen because of the state, would allow more flexibility for testing and contact tracing. Claire, how much testing is going on in Mecklenburg County?
Right, yeah. So I don't know if maybe Nick or Eric, you guys know the specific numbers.
Yeah.
But I know, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, that was an interesting thing this week at the commissioner's meeting. We've been wanting this number, Mike, for a long time. Early on, Gibby Harris mentioned that a couple of hundred tests had been done over a couple day period in March. And then we never got numbers again until the other night, I guess it was Wednesday night, she said 20,000 tests have been administered. So remember, 20,000 out of a population of 1 million in the county, that's not a lot.
And here's why testing is important, if I can hop in, is because your models, for instance, that we just talked about, are only as good as the data that you have. Well, where do we get that data? Well, it's from these tests. So the fewer tests, the less reliable data, which means the less reliable model. Most of the reason you're seeing shifts in models, for instance, is because we're seeing increase in data, both testing and hospitalizations as well, which tends to be lower than what was originally projected, which is, again, a good thing. But the less testing we do, the less data and the less modeling we can do, and that means more stay at home.
And just, where testing is taking place here and around the country, we are discovering, of course, a lot more.
Note.
Yeah, go ahead,
Mike. I was just gonna say one other note. I'm assuming we'll get into this in the second block when we talk more about the state. But Secretary Cohen was talking about that as well, trying to get from I think 2,500 tests to 5,000 to 7,000 tests, which they hit a couple of days this week. But that's where all this testing data that everyone is referring to comes in, and it is so important to figure out how to ease those restrictions.
And I was going to, before that, we're only testing about half, right? So it was like 25. The testing between 2,500 and 3,000. They want to get it up to 5,000 to 7,000, which they've started to do, but they want to be able to do that for an extended period of time.
So I wanted to say that as testing has gone on around the country, we know that more people have this virus than we thought, because testing shows that you may have been asymptomatic and may still be. Maybe you never had it at all, but you're a carrier of it. You never weren't affected by it, but you're a carrier of it. And the reason testing is so important is that can we really, really open up things again without having a handle on how many people are walking around asymptomatic who have this and can pass it on? Can we?
I mean, I think what you're hearing from all of the public health people is that you have to have much more extensive testing. You have to have the tracing. Those are two huge factors before you can begin to even gradually open things back up, never mind getting back to mass gatherings and those kinds of things.
So, Nick, people outside of major metropolitan areas like New York City and Boston and New Orleans, where they have really been impacted, this places like Detroit, people lose sight of the fact sometimes that there are folks out there dying from this. It isn't just being cooped up at the house and being inconvenienced and not getting a paycheck. It's the people are dying from this. And you reported this week that the official coronavirus death counts may be giving us an incomplete picture of the virus's toll. How so?
Yeah. So I worked as part of a statewide collaborative of six newsrooms across the state. And collectively, we wanted to know, is the number that the states in North Carolina reporting accurate? And so to measure that, we pulled thousands of death certificates from counties all across the state from March 1st through now to look. And so we know that in North Carolina, the death count you're seeing are only people who died with a confirmed case of coronavirus. Even if that's not what killed them, coronavirus is known to exacerbate other underlying pre-existing conditions, heart conditions, lung conditions, also some other things. And so what we did is we pulled thousands of death reports and we started looking, one, for instances where likely COVID-19 was listed on the death certificate, but that is not counted in the state, because even if your doctor thinks COVID-19 is what killed you, without that positive test, you can't be officially counted. And again, here's where we go back to a lack of testing is skewing the things we know, because there are people who may have died with the virus, but we don't know because we couldn't get them tested. And so right now, we don't know a true number. If you recall, in New York City, they revised the death toll up by like 3,000 people a week or so ago. This is the same thing, because what we're really, and you would expect to see that in North Carolina, because right now officials are being cautious. They don't want to overestimate or overstate the death toll. So they're only using these laboratory confirmed cases, but eventually public health officials will go back. They'll review death certificates for each county and try to find other people that may have died because of the virus as well.
So the new big buzzword that we've been hearing in the last couple of weeks is contact tracing. Let's talk about that, Claire. Explain what that is, how it works, and how much of it is going on right now here.
Yeah, so yesterday, Secretary Mandy Cohen said that they have 250 contact tracers in the state right now. I'm not sure how many that trickles down to in Mecklenburg County. But what it is basically if someone tests positive for COVID-19, then you go, the contact tracer goes and talks to them, well, I guess these days, calls them on the phone, and walks through kind of every where that they had been in the past 2 weeks or so. So tell me everybody that you may have had contact to from, you know, how many times did you go to Harris Teeter? You know, who, you know, did you have people to your house? And then you try to track those contacts and monitor them for symptoms of COVID-19. The idea being that as soon as that person starts to exhibit symptoms, you can have them isolate and keep them from spreading the virus.
But if you go to the grocery store at 10:30 on a Wednesday morning and you come down with this virus and they start contact tracing you, how do you know who you interacted with or came close to or brushed up against? How do you know?
Right. So, and my colleague Steve Harrison actually on the Inside Politics podcast, they kind of did a little bit of a deep dive on this with Gibby Harris in Mecklenburg County. And Gibby was saying that right now, Mecklenburg doesn't really have the capacity to do that extensive of a contact trace. So they're going to focus on people who are at higher risk, right? So they'll find the people that you may have had contacts with who are more likely, more susceptible, members of a vulnerable population, rather than just any clerk at the Harris Teeter grocery store, because obviously you can really go down a rabbit hole and that's important, but not necessarily the easiest thing to do, according to Gibby Harris.
I want to talk just a skosh more about that when we come back from the break, and then we'll talk about the difference between North and South Carolina and some of the towns around Charlotte who would like to see things reopen more quickly than Charlotte would when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup with Claire Donnelly, our healthcare reporter here at WFAE News, and Doss Helms. We'll have a lot to say about education in the next few minutes. He's our education reporter here at WFAE. Nick Oxner joins us from WBTV in News, where he is an investigative reporter, and Eric Spanberg is the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Getting back to this contact tracing, you mentioned Mandy Cohen, the state secretary of Health and Human Services. She says that the state is looking for a private company to expand the state's ability to identify people who have come into contact with those who may be carrying the virus. First of all, are these companies difficult to find? Is the work that these contact tracers have to do difficult because there are a lot of people, or does it require special training because there are a lot of people out of work right now who could use a job? Claire?
Yeah, so I do know that a lot of nurses are often tapped to do that kind of thing. I think in Mecklenburg County, they're bringing online or have already brought online about 7 school nurses to do it. So I think, yeah, I mean, you're asking a lot of kind of in-depth questions, and it's not, you know, necessarily, I don't know. It's not necessarily just a job that anybody could do. I'm not sure. I think we'll learn more going forward, depending on who they're working with and who they're pulling from. But I don't know if other people have heard any more info on that. But
there, anybody? Nope. Okay. There's a rule that what these stay-at-home orders, we had one first, then the state put one in that was longer than ours, and that eclipsed our order. Evidently, the stronger order holds the day. So if the state removes its order and Mecklenburg County decides to extend, in Mecklenburg County, we have to extend. But there are towns around Charlotte who would like to see these things taken away. They're not interested in extending this. And part of this is now a moot point because of the state extension, but it may go away and we may decide to extend. Huntersville Mayor John Anarella says he's been talking to the mayors in and around Mecklenburg County, and he thinks there is some momentum to open up certain businesses. Which towns is he talking to, and why are they antsy about this, Claire?
Yeah, so, and this is reporting by my colleagues David Borax and Steve Harrison. It sounds like a lot of them are just anxious to move forward into more of the phase one section where some businesses could open. So obviously Huntersville Mayor has said that he would be in favor of reopening more quickly. I know the Davidson Mayor is on board with extending the order. So I think, I don't know, that, and that was part of what Dina DiOrio was saying, the Mecklenburg County manager was saying earlier this week, is that she wasn't sure that the county would have the latitude to be able to extend the order on its own without the governor's help. And she actually had asked the commissioners to write a letter to the governor asking for an extension. So I think, yeah, I mean,
so let's, this is kind of where it gets weird, because the stronger order holds the day. The state order may be weaker than a county order, so the county order would take precedence over the state order. But the county, Mecklenburg County, cannot change orders or put in a blanket order if the towns don't want it. Is that the upshot of this?
Yeah. And that, I'm sorry, Claire, go ahead.
No, I was just saying yes.
I mean, Mike, that's what a lot of this back and forth on the county commission and between the county manager and the county attorney has been about. You remember last week they went back and forth. Dina DiOrio said, oh, I think we have the upper hand here. I think we can do what we want to do. And the county attorney said, no, I don't think so. And they said, well, let's explore further. And what they came back with is what we saw this week, which is that the Mecklenburg County does not have ultimate say. And you heard Trevor Fuller, one of the commissioners, say that he thinks they have a gaping hole when it comes to public health policy and what they can do during a pandemic, because clearly it's got to be unanimous, and getting unanimous consensus is very difficult.
And we are on the border with a state that's trying to reopen more quickly than we are trying to reopen. And people go back and forth between North and South Carolina across our border, right through Mecklenburg County all the time. So what good is our order if South Carolina has a different policy? Just asking.
And that's the thing that's true with these counties, like Gaston County, you hear about wanting to start phasing things in. And they're not talking about just throwing things wide open. But yeah, I mean, in Gaston County here, we are situated right, you know, with Mecklenburg County across the river and South Carolina just adjacent to us. So, and you do see, I think culturally, my husband ran an errand to a Walgreens in Gaston County, and he said it looked almost like regular business as usual. You didn't see many people wearing masks. You didn't see a lot of people really being careful about following the one-way arrows. So you do have a bunch of different sort of not only formal rules, but climates, and yet we're all sharing this same virus.
So there are people, go ahead.
That was something that I was thinking about too, with the Mecklenburg versus the state, is if Mecklenburg County had extended and the governor hadn't, I don't really know. I mean, I don't envy the position then of the county officials trying to enforce the stay-at-home order in this county when you could travel to surrounding counties. So I think, I mean, it's a tricky situation.
So there are these cultural differences that people notice from town to town and from county to county in terms of how seriously they're taking this. And people are also getting impatient around the country and here in North Carolina.
Open North Carolina!
That's the sound of protesters during a second week of Tuesday stay-at-home protests in Raleigh. About 1,000 people, I think, according to Raleigh police, marched past the governor's mansion and the legislative building this week. It happened in Michigan, too, and the governor there commented that the number of people protesting was minuscule in comparison to the population of people in Michigan that were cooperating with this and saw value in it. Would the same be true of North Carolina? Number of protesters tiny in comparison to those who would feel safer if we stuck with this for a while? It's a question. Nobody has an answer.
I think probably so, but I don't know how you measure it other than, you know, certainly the majority of North Carolinians were not there at the protest.
Yeah, it was around 500 people,
yeah, 500.
Which okay. Obviously compared to even the population of Mecklenburg County is pretty small.
So the argument here and around the country is being framed as a question of individual rights. And here's what one protester in Raleigh told WRAL.
Who doesn't get to earn a living? That is not their call. Those that want to quarantine should be free to do so. And those that want to participate in life should be free to do so.
This is a genuinely important question, particularly under our Constitution. When does the general welfare eclipse individual rights? Have there been any rulings on this, court rulings on this, down through our history?
I'm not a constitutional scholar, but, you know, I think this is a question that is coming up a lot more as we move through this pandemic and the restrictions. I mean, I think part of the reason you saw 500 people at the protest this week is because last week police arrested some protesters, right? So part of the large showing this week was you can't arrest us for exercising our First Amendment right, even during a pandemic. And after the arrest last week, we saw a lot of clarification and backpedaling from some parts of our government. About that. And so I think people are starting to wonder more and more, right? Part of the reason that it's so hard for us to get people to stay home is because as Americans, we have this concept of we make our own destiny, right? You don't tell us what to do. and that is a little more difficult of a concept for us to grasp, which is right in normal times, a good thing.
Claire.
We are such a society that has so much distrust of government in general. That certainly doesn't help things. And then when you throw in all the factors that you just mentioned, Mike, about the differences in terms of guidelines and protocol, it just makes for the mess that we've wound up with.
Claire.
It sounds like even, and I think maybe more or at the same level as the individual rights debate is also this economy question. Because I think a lot of people sort of see this as a choice between, you know, like fighting the virus or boosting the economy. Because I talked to a couple of people in the Reopen NC Facebook group, and a lot of them are small business owners who say, you know, my business does the same thing as these big box stores, but the big box stores are allowed to be open with restrictions. Why can't I open? And why, they're saying, why is Governor Cooper sort of choosing these really, you know, stay-at-home order, intense restrictions over kind of the health of the economy statewide.
So and there is there are two sides to this. Obviously, there were two sides in the Michigan protest, and there's that famous picture of a healthcare worker standing in front of a car, stopping them from going into the protest because the healthcare worker was upset that they were protesting because they're putting their lives on the line every day to take care of COVID-19 patients. And the same is true of the protest in Raleigh. One of the protesters there got into an argument with a counter protester who was there to support the medical workers.
Are these people here?
Behind me. They're working hard to protect us.
Well, sir, I don't have a job, lady. My son don't have a job.
Sir,
my sister-in-law doesn't have a job.
You want to go to work?
Yes.
And get this disease tomorrow and die.
I'm not going
to
get it.
I went to work too early, didn't I?
Ma'am,
too late then.
Too late then is right, but I have a right to determine my future. Not you people have a right.
I think the medical profession does because they know what they're
talking
about.
They've been wrong so far, ma'am. They've been wrong.
I don't care to die because
they've been wrong so far.
So tempers are running high here, but he kept saying they've been wrong so far, the medical people. Have they? Where did that idea come from?
Before about how the more successful flattening the curve is, the harder it's going to be to enforce, because if you are living life and the people you know are not sick and dying, and we're not seeing field hospitals and huge mobile morgues in our area, the more you feel like, really, why am I giving all this up? We are hardwired to deal with the tiger that jumps up in front of us and makes our adrenaline pump. And we are not psychologically good at saying, wow, I got to be patient for a few more months. That's really hard to make people believe, especially if it's a really big sacrifice.
So people are having a tough time connecting. They're having a tough time.
Really
people are having a tough time connecting the dots because we have not had to open up field hospitals, and the reason for that is we have flattened the curve by staying at home, and that's a hard message to take, particularly if you don't have an income anymore.
Well, right, and Mike, part of this goes back to the models that we talked about earlier, right? Because people saw the models that saw these big spikes, projected these big spikes, and they say, well, we didn't get a big spike, so I don't trust the model. Well, the models have changed and the curve has flattened again because we're getting new input, more new data, and that data is a lessening of cases. The cases are lessening because we're staying at home.
Well, and also the two points I want to make. One is, of course, this is not an either or argument, but people are turning it into that. You can be concerned about both public health and the economy and try to strike a reasonable balance. Now, there obviously will be plenty of disagreements about what a reasonable balance is. So that's thing one. Thing two is when we talk about the economic toll, remember, Mike, just for example, over 700,000 people in North Carolina in the past six, seven weeks, have filed unemployment claims. In one day, in any one day, you're having more claims filed than you typically would have in an entire month previous to this. So that's just an example of how extensive the economic pain is. And you could hear it in that man's voice. You sort of science, public health be damned. I've got to figure out a way to pay my bills. And there's a lot of that sentiment out there.
Yeah.
There's also, it does kind of go back to the limited testing as well. So it might look like there aren't a lot of cases where you live, but or positive cases, but that doesn't necessarily mean that there aren't a lot of people who live where you live that don't have the virus. We just don't have the testing capacity to actually have good data about who is infected.
Okay, so let's talk about what happened yesterday at the governor's press conference, where he extended the stay-at-home order statewide until May the 8th. He has a plan to reopen. The plan comes in three phases. Explain the plan, Claire.
Okay, so there are a couple things that they're looking for in order to move into this, and that would be... So we've talked about testing. You want to look at not just the number of positive cases leveling off, but the number of positive cases related to, like, the percentage of positives related to the number of tests that you're doing. So you need you could have a high number of people testing positive, but if you're testing a lot of people, then that's important, right? So they need that. Anyway, back to the phases. So phase one, we would still have the stay-at-home order in place, but it would be slightly relaxed. So certain businesses would be able to reopen. People could leave for different commercial activities. The governor mentioned bookstores, retail establishments. So those could reopen. Mass gatherings would still be capped at 10 people though in phase one. Parks could reopen in phase one. Then in phase two, which would happen 2 to 3 weeks later, depending on how the benchmarks go, that would be when dine-in restaurants could reopen, bars could reopen, but they would need to have they would need to be doing the social distancing requirements. So it wouldn't be at the same capacity that bars and restaurants were open before. That would also be when churches could reopen, houses of worship could reopen, again, with limited capacity or reduced capacity. And then in phase three, that would be increasing the capacity at those places. But again, these are all contingent on how we're doing at meeting the benchmarks, because obviously if we start to see an increase in cases, we may need to scale back, go back to phase one, go back to stay at home. So that's kind of all.
Did the governor give a timetable for this? How long he thinks it may take to roll out to phase three? Did he say that at all?
He didn't. And I think that it would be, I mean, I think it's just always, it's going to be a question of continuing to look at the data, continuing to look at how the testing numbers are, how the number or how the amount of PPE is. I think it's all going to be contingent on that.
Phil Berger had asked for this. The Senate Republican leader, Phil Berger, had asked Cooper for this timetable, and he got it. He also wanted the state to disclose the number of people who recover from the COVID-19 virus each day and about their underlying health conditions. Did the governor talk about that yesterday?
I don't think so. That's like a terribly hard thing to track, because yes, from all I've heard, you don't recover like boom. You know, sometimes it looks like you've recovered and you're not over it. So.
And 9th District Republican Dan Bishop said the state needs to give out detailed information about how much personal protective equipment it needs. I believe that Mandy Cohen, the state health director, talked about that yesterday. And we are still short of PPE and ventilators and other things. How short are we? What, if anything, can be done about it? Is it the same problem we've been talking about now for weeks?
That's hard to gauge, and Eric might have more because he looks like he is more informed on this, so I'll let him gauge it.
Okay, Eric, well, 30 seconds.
I only have a teeny bit, which I think Mike Sprayberry, who is in charge with the state of tracking all this down, I think he said they were somewhere around 5% of what they had ordered, right? Of course, you have all these different things in terms of counties and cities and what they have as well.
Well, but here's the problem, and here's why I say it's hard to gauge, is because we don't know what people have asked for. And the statewide reporting collaborative I mentioned earlier, weeks ago, we submitted a request to Department of
Emergency Management. I got to cut you off. We're out of time. We're coming back in a moment at Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
It's Charlotte Talks at the Local News Roundup on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Nick Oxner is an investigative reporter for WBTV News. And Doss Helms covers education for WFAE. Claire Donnelly covers healthcare for WFAE. Let's talk about South Carolina, because, again, North Carolina Governor Cooper has extended the stay-at-home orders here through May 8th, reiterating the need to get things under control.
We understand that stay at home, we can't stay at home forever, and that this is not something that is sustainable long term. But what we have to do is to ease back into it, to make sure that this virus does not spike, which it very easily could do.
And he outlined the plan that we talked about a moment ago. Just minutes from here, though, South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster says the time to reopen is now, and something that can be done safely because of the compliance and common sense people have shown.
We believe that this is that we can do this without, if compliance remains at the high level than it has been, we can do this without endangering the population.
So how does South Carolina compare with North Carolina in terms of the number of cases, the number of deaths? Claire, do you know?
I don't have the exact numbers.
Well, I do. As of Tuesday, they have 4,608 cases and 356 deaths. It's just tiny bits less than North Carolina. Why does the governor feel there that it's time to reopen? Just a difference of opinion? That's all?
Basically, and Mike, when you say they're just slightly behind us, that's a problem because South Carolina as a state is significantly smaller than we are.
Yes.
Half the population, North Carolina. Go ahead, Nick. I'm sorry.
They'd been keeping pace with us. And at one point, I think we're just slightly ahead of us even at the kind of the early start of this, way ahead of us in deaths at the early weeks of this. So I think that speaks for itself.
So let me rephrase it. Is it not just a difference of opinion, but is it the fact that that's a Republican governor and we have a Democratic governor? It's a political difference.
And South Carolina abuts Georgia, which is just like, yeah, let's open it up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Georgia that wants to open so much up that even President Trump said that he thought he was going too quickly.
And there are business people in and around Georgia who said, we're not opening. You can go ahead and lift the order, but we're staying home. What has been the reaction in South Carolina?
Well, I think that's what you're seeing even from Governor McMaster is sort of that we're saying let's not tell everyone to stay at home, but we're not saying rush back out into the streets, right? I think you're seeing that even in the fact that they've shut schools down for the rest of the school year in South Carolina. So it's not a whole scale go back about your lives.
And yet they've opened some stores. They've resumed business on Tuesday. Did shoppers respond? Did retailers see people coming into their stores? We don't know. The governor also approved the state's beaches to reopen, but some of the state's most popular beaches opted to stay closed. This is once again local people saying, I'm not so sure about this. Surfside Beach, which is south of Myrtle, opened only to joggers and walkers and bicyclers. Right next door, Garden City opened fully. Hilton Head beaches are closed. North Myrtle Beach opened on Tuesday, and we're still weeks away from the summer season. Are we being premature on worrying about opening beaches?
Well, I think when you have something that draws in lots of people from all over, that's going to be a risk for the local people. Have got to be hesitant about, let's bring potentially the virus in from all over.
So and if remember, there's a resurgence, go ahead, Eric. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, remember, when you take that risk, those hospitals and healthcare systems are so much smaller. They can be overwhelmed so much quicker that you really are playing a very risky game if you open up beaches.
Plus, the other thing, we don't know the impact of this for 14 days because that's the incubation period of this. So if they open the beaches and everything looks fine and people come out because everything looks fine and they come out again next week because everything looks fine, then 14 days later, kabam, it happens. If there's a resurgence in those areas as a result of that, does that create a greater threat for the tourist season at those beaches than there would have been had they stayed closed a little while longer?
I mean, my hunch is yes, because one of the biggest things that you're hearing businesses of all kinds talk about is not only reopening, but restoring public confidence. How do you make people feel safe? How do you make them want to not only spend money, but go out and spend money? And if you have a resurgence or a big outbreak, obviously people are going to be leery of going to that beach or that city.
So when Governor Cooper held his press conference yesterday, the very first question, once they opened the floor to questions, came from WLOS in Asheville asking about when the state might decide on reopening the schools. That announcement, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Ann, comes this afternoon in another press conference. School Board Chair Elise Dashew here in Mecklenburg County sounds like she is on pins and needles.
Not knowing is really hard, and it will be a relief to know, and then we can be a lot more focused and specific in our planning because we're making all sorts of plans for all sorts of different possibilities.
Will CMS get a heads up on this decision prior to the announcement, or will they hear it as we do, Ann?
I think they'll hear it as we do. I've been pestering people, as I suspect reporters everywhere have, locally and at the state level, to say, what do you know about what he's going to say and when he's going to say it? And I think a lot of people did believe that his 3 o'clock thing on Thursday was going to be about the schools because he had said, I'll announce it this week. And I think what happened was he held off. I can't imagine, is anybody here going to take the case that he's going to let the kids come back? Because, you know, that you can't do a phase one with schools. You can't say we're going to let 10 kids on the bus or 10 kids on, you know, in the classroom. So,
and Delise Dashew says she is doubtful that school will in fact resume this year when the current school closing order ends on May 18th.
I cannot see how we could practice safe social distancing on May 18th. You know, I'm thinking about Kennedy House Middle School, where the kids are so jam-packed in a hallway when classes change that there's just no way you could achieve safe social distancing.
And even if schools do go back this year, she acknowledged that there are a lot of questions still left to answer.
Will we have a situation where some kids go back and some don't? Will we have high absentee rates if we have, you know, concerned families who want to keep their kids home? And what do we do about that?
So it sounds to me like she is pretty convinced that this can't be done this year. What's your hunch, Anne?
I'm going to fall out of my seat if he says, sure, bring everybody back on May 18th. I just think it's almost a foregone conclusion that they won't come back. Now, having said that, if you're streaming it on Saturday and I got it wrong, I guess I'll look silly. But I think the real questions are, how do we do this next? And I think the reason he didn't say anything Thursday was because you had the State Board of Education meeting that morning to talk about how to handle some things. And then you had the House panel on education and COVID-19 meeting to deal with some of the legislative things. And I think he just decided, let's get that cleared out and have everybody out here, because there are a lot of questions. One of the things that the House is looking at is saying, well, we'll fund a special jumpstart supplemental program during August for kids who are falling behind. You know, there are a million questions attached to that. There's always been the idea that you take the most disadvantaged kids and you bring them back earlier. What CMS has seen with its year-round school venture that they eventually discontinued was that it's hard to get them there under the best of circumstances. And if you've got kids who have fallen through the cracks, who are not getting the remote learning, whether that's packets of paper or whether that's internet connection, how do you effectively get them in early? And as Elise mentioned, there are the people who may not know they're supposed to come, and then there may be the families who say, I don't care when you say the schools are safe, my kids aren't coming. This is not safe.
So you reported yesterday that there are a lot of different questions to be asked and answered here about all of this. The State Board of Education has said that there will be no letter grades for most students this year. If you don't have letter grades, how do you promote them to the next grade?
They're leaving that to the principals, and they're saying basically, unless that child was so far behind when we closed the schools that we were already having conversations with the family about retention, you should err on the side of promotion. There, you know, one of the things that they've had to revise is, and it will be up to the legislature, but according to law, you have to pass your third grade reading test to be promoted to fourth grade and or do a summer camp. Well, the summer camps, I think they're assuming, will not happen. The tests are definitely not going to happen. So they're saying, well, we'll bring kids back to fourth grade, but within, I think, 10 days of the start of school, they're supposed to give a reading test. I think implicit in all this is that a lot of next year is going to be playing catch up.
Okay. Also, with the high schools, they're going to do something that they did when I was in college during the Vietnam War protests that closed the schools the year the Kent State shooting occurred. They just told us, and they're going to do this in the high schools. They told us that we could, let me see if I can find my notes on this.
You can take the grade that you had when schools closed. You can keep working remotely if you feel like, oh, I was at a B or a C, but I think I could bring it up, and you're really doing great work online. You can bring it up, or you can take a pass withdraw. That's sort of like pass fail, except that withdraw is not viewed as a failure. If you take a pass grade, you get a credit. If you take a withdrawal, you don't get a credit. But either way, it doesn't affect your grade point average.
Right. Exactly what happened when I was in college. So state education officials also say the schools need $382 million more for virus expenses. They're closed. Why do they have virus expenses?
Well, you have this emergency meals program that, again, it's really extensive, and really they're talking about giving a $5 an hour raise to all the people who are being asked to go out there every day. And even if it's only handing a bag through the window, you know, they're interacting with the public, they're taking some risks. A lot of this has to do with increasing the technology, buying a lot more Chromebooks to send home with the kids, doing more to increase the connectivity. They're saying that's still a huge issue, maybe less so in the urban areas, but in large parts of the state, you can't do online learning if you don't have a good Wi-Fi connection. So there are various other expenses, and I don't have the detailed breakdown in front of me, but this is, again, this is going to be a huge thing when the legislature reconvenes, because it's not just schools, and it's, you know, it's K-12, it's higher education. They all want a lot more money. I'm sure a whole lot of other state systems want and need a lot more money. And there's federal money coming in, there's grant money coming in, but there's also a recession crashing on.
Yeah, the state also heard a request for $25 million more for community colleges, $46 million from the UNC system, an additional $71 million from an independent college association. I'm not sure what all that money is for, but there are money requests coming in from everywhere. The state is paying out extraordinary amounts of unemployment insurance to people. Revenues are down, tax collections will be down, etc. Where is this money coming from? Because unlike the federal government, states cannot print money and they cannot have deficit spending. Where is this money coming from? And how do you explain Mitch McConnell saying, if the states can't afford it, let them go bankrupt? What the hell is that about?
I don't know Mitch McConnell at all. Anybody got any insights on that?
Yeah. So this is a debate that is starting to emerge very quickly in up on Capitol Hill, that McConnell says we shouldn't bail these folks out. We should let them declare bankruptcy so we don't have to send them billions of dollars, because that would be the other option.
But wouldn't the cascading result of that be a crushing blow to the economy? Because the state owes money to businesses and individuals who will then go bankrupt themselves.
You could argue that if you're Mitch McConnell, you would argue on the other side of that coin that it would equally be as crushing to send billions of dollars to states as well. His other point was, and I'm just relaying the points here, is that states should have managed their money better. You know, I guess he wants folks to be like North Carolina, where we have a fairly healthy rainy day fund. He said if they didn't, that shouldn't be the you know, problem now.
Yes, but haven't Republicans argued for years that if you have a rainy day fund, then you're collecting too much money in taxes and you ought to give it back?
The North Carolina General Assembly would say that we've given people their money back and we've kept a responsible rainy day fund. Again, I'm just relaying what they have said.
Before we run out of time, we've been talking about the last couple of weeks about the inordinate number of African-American people who are catching this virus and who are dying from this virus, but they are not alone. This is taking a terrible toll on nursing homes around the country. Nick, you reported that the state is being less transparent about the impact of this virus than other states. Does that include what they're telling us about the impact on nursing homes?
Absolutely. Again, this is a story our collaborative released just last night, and we found that the state is refusing to identify nursing homes with outbreaks identified as two or more cases in a congregate care setting. They have so far refused, and that's a real problem when you talk about counties. Some counties have identified, like Mecklenburg County, are identifying individual facilities. Other counties, like Iredell and Cleveland, are not identifying. And so, there is no actual legal basis, and lawyers for 19 media organizations across the state sent a strongly worded letter to DHHS yesterday saying essentially we're going to file a lawsuit if you don't give us this information. But they're citing, generally speaking, HIPAA. One county who just escaped me at the moment said they were releasing they were identifying individual facilities, and they stopped after one facility got, quote, bullied and harassed after they were identified as a location with an outbreak.
Some of the same problems are being found in veterans' homes. We don't have time to talk about this. I want to talk about one more issue, because you've been covering this for months now. McCrae Dowless, the man at the center of the 9th Congressional District scandal, was back in the news this week because he's facing fraud charges from the federal government, this time on Social Security fraud. Very quickly, in about 30 seconds, explain that.
Yeah, the feds had been investigating the voter fraud issue just like the state had. Dallas had been indicted twice on state charges related to election fraud. The feds said, we don't think there are any federal charges related to the election behavior, but he was collecting Social Security disability benefits at the same time he was getting paid to run these political operations. And so we think there's a violation of federal law there. So he was indicted on Tuesday on 4 federal charges.
And he pled not guilty to the voter fraud charges. Has that gone to court yet?
It has not yet gone to court.
Okay. Busy, busy summer and fall ahead of McRae Dallas, I guess. That's Nick Oxner, investigative reporter for WBTV News, Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal, and Doss Helms, our education reporter at WFAE, and Claire Donnelly kicked us off. She's our health reporter here at WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour. Stay safe.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.